Now enjoy part two of our conversation with Jack Watterson.
Hi, this is Soraya.
And this is Jeff.
Our podcast is called Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme.
A podcast where the two of us play music that we like and share anecdotes and background about the tunes.
We hope you'll join our conversation. And without further ado, a groovear.
Let's get groovy.
Jack, Jeff and I want to ask a couple of questions, if we could, about your solo work. And I want to start out with your 1988 release, Whose Dog? And something that Jeff and I were just curious about is, so on that record, you have some familiar faces and names that also play on this. So from The Long Riders, Tom Stevens, from Rain Parade, John Thoman, adding guitar, and as well, Will Glenn on fiddle. And we were wondering, is that him on Road to Hell?
Yes. He played three parts, and I named them Fiddle, Faddle, and Fuddle. was credited as having performed Fiddle, Faddle, and Fuddle on that record. He did three parts. So.
Okay.
Never seems to satisfy me. No, that never seems to satisfy me. Hey, man, ain't it all too close? Just two steps from Tartaros, the road to hell. Is lined with good intention, but that never seems to satisfy me. No, that never seems to satisfy me. Satisfy me. That answer never satisfies me. Hey, man, ain't it all sincere? You got all my bullshit right here. To satisfy me, that never seems to satisfy me. No, that answer never satisfies me.
But these are all friends of mine. I mean, these are dudes I hang out with, you know, these
right.
are my homies, and, you know. They're my friends, and so they're musicians as well. And you know, these are the people who get you. These are the people who are patient with you and know you and know what you do to some extent and whatever, and willing to contribute their time to you. And you know, I mean, same thing with Chris. He drew from the same pool because you know the first iteration of Junkyard Love was what, Thoman,
right?
Tom Stevens. Keith Mitchell, I think, played. Yep. Yeah, Keith played one.
Yep.
I mean, these are all like you just drawn from your pool of friends, and you know each other. So, you know, and, it's a natural conclusion rather than, you know, you could go find people. I like doing right. that. So, but, you know, I mean, there's definitely something like you can call your friends up, hey, man. And Tom was very generous to me, and I was able to repay that favor to him by producing a record for him. So, because I did one, I harpooned money out of a German label I was connected with. And Tom and I did the pre-production through cassette tapes. So he'd send me a cassette tape, and I'd listen to it and drive around with it and sing over it and come up with stuff. But then I had him come out here, and we took over a friend of mine's like really creepy 8-track studio in Hollywood and knocked that record out. And but that was me repaying Tom for him doing his dog with me. And Tom was incredibly patient. That record took forever to do. So not fits and starts. I mean, I had absolute intention because, you know, I mean, I honestly, like, my whole thing was to get a record out before anybody else in Green on Red because I already divested myself from the band. So my goal with that record was to do something before anybody else. So that's why I did it. And I bulldozed through it. And, you know, there's some things on there that I think are pretty good, and there's some things on there I think are like, well, whatever, man, you know, who cares? But it was fun to do, and, you know, a good experience, and, you know, without too much looking around, I found a home for it, and Pat Thomas had already been dabbling around with, like, Stephen Roback, and I don't know, with Chris yet or not, I'm not totally sure, but Pat managed to get that out on a rough trade, which, you know, it's a good thing, but then unfortunately, at the time, Rough Trade got the life sucked out of them by a bad distribution company, I believe called Green World, went under in Europe. And with Green World went, it was like the asteroid hits the Earth and all the dinosaurs died. So all the independent labels in Europe took a massive hit. And then right around 88, but it just devastated all of it. And then, you know, that basically put, it kind of sank Rough Trade, you know, for a while. I mean, they resurfaced, I don't know how or whatever, but they got the record stores and now. I see that in the UK, but you know, so it was like, hey, not gonna be a tour, there's not, you know, so like stuff just kind of like, but you know, whatever, who cares? It doesn't really matter. And then I think I waited about 4 years after that, and then I did another record for a German label, and that was quite a good record, Invisible Enemies, I think. And I did that under the band moniker of Tulane Blacktop, because performing under my name bugged me at the time. Because you're third person yourself.
So where did that name come from for that
project? I stole it from the movie. No real reason. Okay. It was an odd, very odd, almost unwatchable film that I found intriguing. And then I thought it had the right sort of, you know, sort of ambiguity to it that I was cool with it. And I didn't want anything other than performing under my name. So I went with that. And the record is quite good. And that was a bass player who I met, who was a parking cop, Lou Silva. The drummer was a gentleman named Jim McGrath, who was an incredibly talented individual. He'd come from New Jersey, and he was the original drummer in Bon Jovi's band.
Wow.
Then he was a practical joker, and he pulled something on Bon Jovi and got fired right at the beginning of the incline of Bon Jovi's career. And he sold everything and bought a conga. And he started to study percussion, and he is brilliant.
Wow. I mean,
brilliant. There was some television show. It wasn't Twin Peaks. It was something like that. And like big percussive. That was him playing on that. So he was doing session work. He did like meditation, self-release like meditation CDs, and he sold like enough to, you know, quantify what would be the same way you make doing a gold record or something. So, but great player. And then Tom Watson, who had been in a band called Slovenly. And Tom still plays with Mike Watt. And Tom is a great musician and a great guitar player. And man, he was wonderful to play with. But that whole band was, I mean, I was very fortunate. Those guys were really good. And I had a very good producer at the time, who later drank himself to death, but a really good record. And that, you know, same thing. I mean, it came out in Europe.
And what was the name of that record?
That's called Invisible Enemies. That's a study of mental illness, that whole record. So, but Invisible Enemies, which is, you know, I don't even know what that's like to try to find. I think it only came out on CD. It only came out in probably Germany. And then the record label signed with Sony, and they wasted all their money shooting videos, and they went under. Yeah, that was it for them. Great label, though. The guy had amazing taste. He put out the craziest stuff, man. He put out, you know, he put out records with huge audio drops in the middle of them. Just challenging, like, really, like, no fear. And the band, the Keystone, the whole thing. Really one of the most marvelous bands I ever heard in my life was a band called Smiles in Boxes.
Oh.
Smiles in Boxes. Oh, my God. Brilliant. So German band. And I have the CD somewhere. I'd love to find it. There's no one I ever played that for that wasn't like, what is this? This is the best stuff, man. So they had a record. Their first one is called Housewives and the Unemployed. And I'm pretty sure they did it at home. And it's marvelous. I mean, that is a great record.
It's
a really cool label. But, you know, unfortunately, I mean, bad decision making and, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
This stuff kind of keeps doing that, so whatever. Who cares?
So, Jack, you mentioned that you paid Tom back for producing the Who's Dog record. You did multiple records for him, didn't you? Last Night, Another Room, and Points Revisited?
There were...
I think several.
Revisited has some things that we recorded at a friend of his studio out in the valley. And so there was a few different like recordings we did with each other. But the culmination of the whole thing was really Tom applied himself and helped me do Who's Dog, and I repaid him with that record that went out to went on Doggy Bag. But yeah, there was other things we've done, but that was not uncommon. I mean, I bought a 4-track cassette and did some of Chris's first solo work with him on a 4-track cassette. So some of the songs from his first record were done on a 4-track cassette at my old girlfriend's house, at her parents' house. So, you know, so we all, you know, but you're friends. You know what I mean? You're hanging out, you're friends. Somebody's got something, you need it, they help you out, whatever. You need something, I got this, you need a bar equipment. When we recorded Gravity Talks, it was with all of the equipment.
Our
stuff was all beat up and broken. We borrowed all their equipment. So Gravity Talks was recorded with Rainford's gear.
Wow.
I used Steven's bass, you know, because all our stuff was beat up and thrashed. And they helped us out. So that, you know, but that's what friends do, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
You live in the right when you know you live in the right neighborhood when your car breaks down and your neighbors come up and help you push it to the curb. That's when you live in the right neighborhood, right? That's a sign. So right. when you got the right friends and you need to get the car pushed, they help you push that car. And that's how it works. And that's really as simple as it is. And the relationship with all these people, you know, at its best it's like that. At its worst it's an associate. But even associate things cool. But you know, then there's real homies and sort of people you know. You know what I mean? Like there's a lot of people I don't really even need to talk to again. However, there's some that I love to death. And, you know, we stay in touch constantly. So, you know.
Well, you know, and kind of piggybacking on that, we're really interested in your relationship with Adrian Young and Midnight Hour. We're really intrigued by this most recent part of your musical resume, and from what we can tell, you started working with Adrian in 2009, joining him on drums on the soundtrack Black Dynamite.
Black Dynamite came out in 2008 or 2009.
Okay.
2009, I think you're right.
Uh huh.
We'll be right back. was still there. Something could be anywhere. In the street or uptown. I got a feeling I shouldn't be hanging around.
How did you guys start working together?
Well, I own a music store. Adrian was a young dude who'd come into my store, and he was sharp. And I got a lot of people asking me a lot of questions. I know a lot about this subject. So I get a lot of people asking me all sorts of stuff. So some people are actually worth putting a lot of time into. And so I'll run across people and artists who exhibit this drive and this intention and passion, and they're with it, and they're paying attention, and they're working, and they're completing stuff. These people I feed. Other ones, maybe not so much. But then some people you run into are really worth the investment. So Adrian was 19, I think, when I met him. And I think I was probably about 41 when I met him. 40. And a sharp kid from the Inland Empire. And he'd come in, we'd talk about music. He'd ask me about recording. I'd turn him on to King Crimson. He'd school me on Wu-Tang and, like, you know, stuff like this. And so we'd go back and forth and back and forth, and we became friends and deeper conversations and hanging out all the time. And he had directed a film that was a study of dance, Respond to Sound, quite an interesting film. I went to the opening for that. And, I mean, when his daughter was born, you know, he'd, like, hey, I'm gonna go get this thing out of my car. Here, hold the baby, and I'd hold the baby, you know. So we became friends, and then he would, you know, he's like working on something, and he'd gone to law school, graduated, and got involved with friends of his making a film. They were gonna make a blaxploitation film. So he showed me the trailer in his car, like a Range Rover, with like a DVD player in there. And so he showed me the trailer, which was insane, because it was a real homage to the genre of film, but it held nothing back as far as just sort of the ludicrous nature of things, but also such a beautiful homage to the, you know, the rise of the alpha black male. And it was really fascinating. And this was entirely, you know, black writer, black actors, black director, black screenwriter, black editor, black composer, and this beautiful take on blaxploitation. So he showed me the trailer, and I said, look, man, I got two unrealized dreams in life. One is to be a honky killed in a blaxploitation flick, and the other is to write biker fiction. So I didn't get the gig killed, but I did play drums on it. And I was playing drums, and I don't know if this had anything to do with it or not, but one of James Brown's last bass players, I would get together and jam with that guy. So I don't know if that had anything to do with me playing with Adrian or not. I never even qualified that, but that's what I was doing at the time. And so I got a ringside seat to watching the whole Black Dynamite thing go together, which was fascinating. And then he wanted to put a live band together to play the score. And the score got an enormous amount of love because it sounds like lost gold from that time period. And people would listen to it and go, where did you find these cuts? You know, where did this come from? Oh, this guy did it. And so the magazine Wax Poetics put the record out. And because of the importance of that magazine and how revered it was, immediately it got attention. But then the film grew as a cult thing, and its theatrical release was minimal, but its DVD and cable thing was enormous. And so it eventually became a cartoon on Adult Swim, so it had two seasons as a cartoon.
Oh.
I think that's my last drum performance is the theme for that. Like, I was like, okay, that was the end of my drumming with Adrian. And then I started playing guitar with him shortly after that. So.
Wow.
But that's how I know him. So he was a sharp, driven, interesting, articulate, deep cat at a very young age. And I just, you know, I loved him. I mean, he was just like somebody I talked to. Tell him something, he'd go away. 2 weeks later, he'd be coming back and challenging me on what I said to him. You know, it was wonderful. Like, and so, I mean, today, I'm not kidding you. I got up at 6 o'clock this morning, and I was at the studio recording at 7:10 in the morning for a band called Azimuth, who I don't know if you know anything about them or not, a Brazilian jazz fusion band. So he's finishing a record that he did with them, and so I went. So by 7:10 in the morning, I'm playing with them, and we live very close to each other, and like we can leave, both walk from our houses, and we see each other within a minute and a half. My store is within a quarter of a mile of my house. His studio is within about a half a mile of here.
Oh, wow.
Our world is like nothing. Like when we're in LA, we're in this neighborhood exactly. And so, but I mean, I adore him, and I'm very grateful to have had the opportunity to be exposed to what I've been exposed to and to be able to play music like that, because I mean, it's challenging and deep. I've had to study. I've never been a better player than I am right now. I started studying music and digging my heels in and learning more about it. So now I can talk some real shit about like theory and all that. Pretty good. And I'm studying more right now. I'm studying with two different people, and I'm not telling either of them that I'm studying with somebody else. So it's fun, and it's a really fun gig. And then Ali Shahid, who's the DJ from Tribe Called Quest, got in the mix about maybe 8 years ago now. And he's amazing. What a good dude he is. And again, professional, driven, great time, supernatural cat, man. No diva of anything. I mean, we're moving stuff. We're laughing at each other out in the rain, moving road cases around and stuff. I mean, this guy is wonderful. And so watching him, because playing an instrument apparently in the dawn of hip hop with like, what are you doing? You know? And so you're supposed to be playing, you know, spinning records. And so he always was moving in that direction because he realized, like Adrian did, that there's a limitation to what you can do if what you're doing is sampling. Because at some point you run out, right? And you have bars in your head and things in your head. And how do you get them out of your head? Well, what do? Go digging for records until you find that thing in your head. Or do you create that thing in your head? So this is really fundamentally the evolutionary next step in hip hop, is for people to write their own music and then treat that, you know, as if you're going to construct it like hip hop, then run it like it is, or, you know, change the nature of what hip hop is. But the compositional aspect of it was sort of what got lost and never capitalized on. But then when you play, you know, when you play with a great MC, and I've had the great fortune of working with some of the very best. I mean, I've toured with Ghostface, I've played with Rakim, I've been the backing band for Wu-Tang, I've worked with DJ Premier, Royce da 5'9", Kendrick, shit. I mean, it goes on and on and on, because we get a lot of love in that world. So, you know, I get to be the old white dude who plays guitar, but it's fascinating because it's like, I get it, and I've been around it a lot at this point. And it's fascinating, and I'm really, really grateful that I'm in the position I'm in, because very few people not only have a career as long as I have had, but have had one that's really as like diverse as well. I go all the way from playing a punk band in 1979 to what I'm doing today. It's insane.
Wow. Wow. Jack, I didn't know anything about Adrian Young until we started doing more research and preparing for this. One of the records that you guys did that really stood out for me was the 2016 release, The Electronic Void, The Black Noise.
Beware the black noise. Too much may kill you, a little to keep you alive. Electricity, magnetism. You are attracted, pulled together. When the black noise hits, the polarity flips. Pushed apart, you heard a name and a spark flew down your spine. It's never the bolt, but always the amp. Electricity makes your heart beat. The synapse fire, static in the air, Saint Elmo's fire. Tesla warned Edison, beware the black noise. Thank you.
And yeah, Electronic Void was really funny.
And you're doing narration on that, right?
So what it was Adrian wanted to do an electronic record. So what he'll do is he sort of picks an aesthetic that he wants to move in that direction. Then rules come out, like how are you going to do it? What instruments you use, you know, whatever. So he acquired a good hoard of some analog synths and all that. And I think almost everything came from me, or I advised him on it, because, you know, I mean, I've sold him so much equipment at this point, it's staggering. And he started working on the record, and he said, oh, I want you to do dialogue on this. And so I've done some filming, you know, some acting kind of stuff for him, and created a character, Johnny Douglas, that we keep repeating. And so it's been this whole, like, kind of thing. And so he goes, I want you to do this narration on it. I'm like, all right, whatever. Like, what do you want it to be about? Because I don't know, figure it out. So I did it as, like, I don't know, like, sort of examining love through science kind of thing. And so it was meant to be sort of tongue-in-cheek, like an instructional thing from the 60s. And then it was what it was. So, you know, I went and banged out and wrote it, and then we did the whole record, and, you know, it was interesting, and I don't know how it did. I don't know. I mean, it's an odd record.
It is odd. It's fun to listen to.
Oh, my God, it's bizarre. But we had actually a tour plan for that.
What?
And we had the whole thing animated, and we had it all set up, and we had this minimized thing we were going to do. I was playing 2 cents and going to do the whole, like, spoken thing and whatever. And so we had it all ready to go. And then one morning he called me up, and I was here at the store, like, 7:30 in the morning working on the music. And he was like, what are you doing? I go, you're bugging me, dude. I'm working on music. And he goes, oh, man, I got to tell you something. You got bad news. I'm like, what's that? He goes, tour's canceled. I'm like, okay. But it was a fun musical challenge, because I knew that something was going to go bad more than once. So if the projection locked, the show's done. But we had enough instrumentation where we could play as a smaller ensemble. So I looked forward to the challenge of everything derailing. Like, hey, we're going to play like a live band now. And then just morph right into that and just go over and pick up instruments and start playing. Because nobody does that.
Mm.
Nobody does that. Nobody does an electronic show like that. Go, hey, guess what? Well, that screwed up, so we're going to go play. And so I was looking forward to it going bad, and then it got canceled. And we never looked back. I was like, okay, next. But that's the way it is with him, because he moves at such an incredible pace. I mean, there's been more than a few records that we've done, you know, that I've participated in, and we'll get, you know, do a show, and I'm like, man, the only time this music is ever going to be performed for an audience is this one show. Like, we did, you know, they did him and Ali did the first season of Luke Cage, and we did a show at the Ace Theater downtown.
Okay, yeah.
And there was like a 27-piece orchestra.
Oh.
And the music was intense, and there was a conductor. I don't read music, I remember it. So I had to remember and learn all this stuff, and I'm only going to play this one time. And sure enough, I don't think we've repeated one note of any of that music, and we played for like an hour and a half.
Wow.
Never repeated one note of it. But that's the way it is. Like, I mean, there was a record that came out, and one of the artists, I'm going to be diplomatic and not mention it, I could tell was hoping that this was going to, the ball was going to keep bouncing, and I knew in my heart, this is the only show that's ever going to happen for this record. Well, it's cool, whatever, man. Yeah. You know, what are you going to do? You let it happen once. So, and then that's exactly what happened. We performed it once. That's it. And we never did the material again. So the show happened one time. So, you know, all the learning and all the... I just found, actually, my cheat notes from all that stuff. I ran across. I found it in a little envelope. I'm like, oh, wow. It's all those songs. Oh, I never have to play them again. But I must have learned and performed 200 or 300, I don't know, a couple hundred songs with him at this point. Like, safely. Like, I'd say that's a pretty safe number. A couple hundred, probably, right?
Wow.
And what can you tell us about the new release, Adrian Young Presents Jack Watterson?
Well, that was Adrian hit me up, and he had sort of a grand vision of the people that are the regular cast members should be artists on their own right. So, which is fine, you know. And so I've been down that road before. So I was kind of cool. I like being, a contributor. You know, being the person is a very different thing. But I love putting my assets into something. I did it with Dan and Green on Red. It's like, you know, I mean, I thought he was exceptional, and I thought he really had something to offer. So my greatest thing to do would be to contribute to that, to make it happen and keep it together and keep the ball rolling. So when I find somebody artistically who I believe in, I want to contribute to them, you know, and I don't need to be the guy. I don't need to have everybody pat me on the back. I don't need it. So the record was kind of Adrian's idea. I had no driving thing like, oh, I got to do a record. You know? I didn't care at all. I was happy doing what I was doing, you know? So he hit me up and goes, oh, man, you know, you should do a record. And I'm like, oh, okay. And he goes, well, what are you listening to? I go, Sammy Davis. And he goes, okay, we won't do that. I'm like, well, what do you want to do? And he goes, I want to do a psych record. I'm like, all right. And so we got together, and we played each other a bunch of music. So I played him, like, number one lowest common denominator, that Todd Rundgren song.
Oh.
Like, you know, we always have, I told you I turned him on to King Crimson, so got him a King Crimson. So we just went back and forth a bunch of music, and then started kind of hacking the record out. And then some of the stuff we'd write together, some of it were tracks that he had, and he just, you know, send me a track and he'd go, finish it. And so I'd finish it. And so, because I don't sit around and think too much about this anymore, because I realize that it doesn't really serve anything. So I know what's good and I know what's bad in my mind. So if I just dive in and just get it over with, it's going to be what it is, you know? So I'm good. I'm totally good. And you can look at anything and like nitpick it and, oh, that could have been better. And if only I'd done that or this, like, really, who cares, man? Like, at some point, let it go. You got to let it go. And then the record just kept progressing. And during the course of it, you know, we're trying to figure out what the sort of the underlying narrative of it was. I realized that it's the truth was really what was interesting. Like, how do I know him? You know, the kind of things you intimate into a bio become the dialogue when you get interviewed. And so one of the things I said, it's an examination of black and white music. People are going to ask you, they go, what does that actually mean? Like, wow, that's crazy. So, yeah, because you got two different dudes from two different worlds
right.
who communicate, you know, who get along, and this is their common thing in music. So, and it really is, you know, in its analysis, it is an examination of black and white music, because you can feel all the, you know, all those influences and all those things in there. And, I'm quite proud of it. I had no real, like, I got to do a record. It wasn't like that at all. It was just like, you should do this. Like, okay, why? Well, the band's going to be like Voltron and everything. And then we're going to do this thing and then we're going to come together. And so our last tour was literally like Voltron, because I would open up the show with the singer we worked with for a long time, Lauren Oden, who has a record coming out. He's an amazing vocalist and a wonderful human being. And he did a record with Adrian that's, you know, I mean, it's saying a lot and not saying enough, but it's like contemporary Marvin Gaye. So every song, I mean, it's vulnerable soul singer, going to kill you, crush you, break your heart, you know, fully, and it's orchestrated. Every song on that record is orchestrated. And there's a young girl that we took out on the road who was 17 at the time, and she's from the neighborhood here, and she sent Adrian an Instagram video of her singing.
Yes.
And she's impressive. I mean, she's otherworldly impressive. Angela Munoz.
Yes.
So Angela finished her record. And it's insane. Like, the first single comes out at the end of January. People ain't ready. I mean, this girl is really something else. So Laura and I had done an opening set in Europe. And it was me playing guitar, him playing Rhodes, drummer Dave Henderson, saxophone player Shai Golan, and trumpet player called named Zach Promisier. So the horns got it out of like boring singer-songwriter world. And then when we were going to go on this last tour, Angela was coming with us, so I started to have rehearsals at the store for the opening act. And I said, what do you want to do? Do anything you want. Do whatever you want. You can stand there. Doesn't matter. She goes, well, I don't want to sit behind anything. I said, all right, you'll play bass and guitar. So I started schooling her on playing bass and guitar, and she ran with it, and she was wonderful. Wow. And I would show her parts that I had that I'd written for Lauren's stuff, and I'd play bass on that, and I'd show her my guitar parts, and she'd nail them, and then expound on that, and she's marvelous. And so we had this whole opening set, and Angela will drop people when she starts singing. Like, she is so otherworldly. It was hilarious, because I know what's coming. I mean, I know the show, so I know the audience don't know anything, right? So I'd start the set, and I purposely did a song that was a real thumb in the eye to disorient you. And so I had her playing fuzz bass on it, and it's a gnarly little tune, but it's sort of it's a song called The Legend of Shorty George. And it's a story about a guy who's small, but he's an incredible dancer. And he's born in the dirt, right out in the street, right? Everybody's like, oh my God, he's incredible. And Shorty, like, everybody's into Shorty. So one night there's a fire in an apartment building, and Shorty goes up to start rescuing the people. And he goes in one last time. And we can tell by the sound the building comes down. And Shorty had gotten his heavenly crown. So the legend that sprang right from the dirt, right from the street, met his maker, his story complete. Shorty, oh Shorty, the people would wail. It's a weird thing to do to people. Like, it's a demonic progression. It's a very weird song. So we'd start with that. And I knew, like, you know, and I talked quite a bit to the audience at that point. But I knew when it came time for Angela, these people are going to get knocked out. And sure enough, it happened every night.
Wow.
And she's marvelous. So, you know, so then we would all, you know, get back together in about 15, 20 minutes after that, then play for about an hour and a half. And during the course of that, Angela would sing, Lauren would sing, and then I would do another song, and that was the end of the night. So it was cool. So, but that was the whole goal, is to make, you know, his thing was to make the regular cast members sort of their own entity. Which is sweet, because, you know, it gives me options outside of it if I want to do it.
Right.
But it establishes sort of the character in the whole band. So it's cool. I mean, it's you know, I get it, but it was never, none of my thinking. It was like, it was him. I'm just like, going, okay, sure, I'll do that. I had no burning desire, like, oh, I've got these deep songs I have to get. It's not like that at all, man. I just like, okay, cool, we're doing a record. All right, go. Write it. Done. You know, next song. Okay. So I didn't even think about that much. Nice. But it was interesting. It did well, and people cared about it. And whatever. I might do another one too. I don't know.
Excellent. Well,
yeah, maybe.
So you put out a couple of videos for the album "Smile" and "Flashback," right? And both have LSD references in it. So in "Smile," I think you're dropping.
Yeah, I think it's have acid in it.
That's what I took it to be.
Yeah.
And then in "Flashback," you have that whole hallucinogenic little monologue at the beginning.
Good evening. Tonight, I would like to talk to you about hallucinogens, or head drugs, such as LSD. These drugs are known to cause permanent psychosis, a severe mental disorder whereby the user loses touch with reality. Scientists from the University of Michigan have discovered disturbing physical and psychological effects while listening to certain melodies under the influence. It seems to alter the sense of what is real, what is normal. If a person feels a tendency to be sexually promiscuous, any reservations are dropped during these melodic trips, a flashback of sorts to our primitive sensation with sound. Tonight, I will volunteer my own brain to demonstrate the heightened effects of LSD while listening to Adrian Young Presents Jack Watterson.
bright sun, daylight, walking all the way home. Hold tight, it's slipping. The walls were dripping. I knew I was tripping. The reel in my grasp, a deep vision red. We lived like royals, awoke to toil. Imaginary enemy, come for me again. I went there once with paper and pen. Moonrise, sunset, coyotes need love too.
What was the thought process into that topic?
Well, part of what sort of came up while we were doing the record is Adrian kept telling me he wants to do a psych record. He's never gotten high once in his life.
Oh.
Never drank, never smoked, none of that. Now me? I have. And so I was like, well, you keep talking about wanting to do a psych record, but you've never done anything like this. So I'm going to make that the subject. And then I just dug in and I just started writing about the psychedelic experience, be it like in its raw form, like you're actually doing drugs, or sort of the impressionistic end of it. And, you know, it's up to the listener to decide what you want to do with that. It's not up to me. I'm telling you a factual story. And if you know me and you listen to that record, all those lyrics are absolutely, you can pinpoint the moments in my life. I can break them down and tell you like what that line means and who it's about without question.
So it's very autobiographical.
The truth was the most compelling thing. Stick with the truth and just make that everything. Don't hide anything. Tell everybody everything and don't hold back and really be honest. And that's how I approached the record. So, and then it made it its own narrative too, because like the story, the true story of what it is interesting enough and better than any bullshit I could have cooked up. So, you know, that was a lot more. And it worked. And I mean, people really, you know, people understood it, you know, because they realized like, oh wow, this guy really is not holding back anything at all. Like, I'm telling you the honest and God truth, and I'm trying to give you an impression of what this is like,
right?
Because I'm basically also telling Adrian at the same time and informing him. So where the nature of our relationship is informing each other, this is me informing him about that,
right?
Makes sense.
Absolutely.
And to me it does.
Yeah. And so the videos are you know, there's enough sort of production capability amassed at this point to where they can be quality, but you know, you're still under constraints of time and budget. So these things are, how clever can you be with minimal assets? And you know, just trying to find somebody to play a role convincingly, good luck, man. Like, that's a hard thing to do. Like, trying to find somebody that can actually convincingly lapse into something and pull it off, it's not that easy. And so location, restrictions in lighting, like all this little nuanced stuff takes over, and it's not any world I've ever invested myself in. And it's the hardest thing I ever did with him creatively, is cook up video concepts, because I don't know. And but I've learned, and so now I know how to propose something and have it make sense and have it be something doable. So there's another one that's written at this point that hopefully we'll get around to doing. But the next one, really crazy.
A song from the album?
Yeah, we're going to do another one.
All right.
Yeah, there's a song called Larceny, I think, on that record, and so it's probably going to be, it'd be for that one. So, but that one is a very jarring piece of work. And I enjoy it because it's a funny thing to do. And, you know, I mean, if you're willing to take a risk and really stick your neck out and not be afraid of people's reaction or whatever, and be completely like in the moment and free with the whole thing, it's fun, man. I mean, it's a really fun thing, because I like making people feel uncomfortable. I don't mind that at all. I mean, I want you to wonder about me. You know, I'm cool with that. Like, I want you to keep guessing. I don't want you to know me, really, to a point. Or maybe you did, whatever. But I, you know, I mean, it's, that's interesting artistically, because nobody really knows what they're getting, but they get what they get. You know what I mean? But there's no like, I'm gonna sit around and like make sure I look good. You know, I don't care, man. I'm bald. I'm short. I don't give a shit. You know what I mean? In one of those videos, I have no shirt on for a reason, because it sends a message to you as a viewer. You're like, wow, this guy really is. He's basically naked. No problem. Like, I'm totally cool with all that, because it's interesting to me, and I do like to keep people guessing. You know, and with that kind of thing, and you do a video, it's your opportunity, man, to do something weird. A lot of people do something so middle of the road and boring, it's nauseating. Why? You've got an opportunity to do something crazy, man. Like, really, like, dig your heels in and do something weird. Difference to make, you know? Like, really, how many people are going to see it anyway? Like, it's not like, you know, millions of see it and hate on you, you know? It doesn't matter. Like, who cares, man? And then it's a long, like, you know, it's another thing you did. And so, like, to me, at this point in my life, it's like, well, how much more stuff can I throw on the pile of what I did already? That's an interesting thing, you know? What more can I do? Okay, we'll keep going, ready? Don't be boring. Don't be the person you would have hated when you were 20.
Oh, so one last question for you then. Aside from the video for Larceny, which I don't know, you left that little seed, and now I'm super curious. What else is in store for Jack Watterson in 2020?
Well, we're gonna tour again this year, because we, for the past year and a half with the Midnight Hour, you know, we sucked it up and we did the hard stuff. And, you know, when you start touring with any act, you go through, you know, it's not like one day you wake up and you're on a bus and everything's cool. No. You know, first Green on Red tours were insanely rugged. I mean, we drove from Tucson to Boston not knowing where the next show was. Wow. Taking it on faith from the booking agent that everything was cool. We drove straight through from Tucson to Boston, not knowing where the next show was. We broke down, I don't know how many times. We got in a wreck and had to hole up in a hotel during a hurricane on the East Coast. You know, we were in a freezing vehicle driving from Oslo to Stockholm with no heater in January, like dying in the vehicle, freezing to death. You suck it up. And then hopefully you get to a point where you're not sucking it up anymore. So I know that. And so this past year and a half, we've been kind of sucking it up. But whatever. I mean, it doesn't matter. It's fun, you know? And then, you know, you keep doing it. So you can't do that and stop. You have to do it, and then you go do it again, and then you go do it again, and you go do it again. So the goal from discussions is that we're going to wash, rinse, repeat everything we did over the past year and a half. So we'll go back to Japan, we'll go back to Brazil, go through Europe again, and do the States again, and see what else comes up.
Wow.
It will ramp up towards the end of the year.
I will say to our listeners, you need to go check out the Tiny Desk performance of the Midnight Hour. This performance is incredible. That, please go do yourself a favor and go and watch that incredible performance right there by you guys. So I'm looking forward to catching a live show now that I've seen some of these.
It's always, you know, the live act is really, with that band, is really something else, man, because it's musically all over the place.
Yeah.
So it goes everywhere from, you know, you can quantify it as jazz to, like, you're going to get kicked in the throat rock and roll, because there's some moments of that show that are out of control.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Oh, by design. Man, because, you know, I come from a rock and roll background, so to me, no matter what kind of music I'm playing, it's always rock and roll. It could be the most gentlest, quietest thing, but in my mind, I'm still like, you know, I'm still going to kill it, because that's how I approach it. And, you know, when you have that thing and you're playing with other people, you can kind of smear it on them a little bit. So I like to push the rock aesthetic even no matter what the music is, because playing from the gut is exciting. It's not only exciting as a player, but it's exciting to the audience, man. When it's like, you know, you can have the greatest players in the world. We had a great conversation one night about ability and sensibility. Those are two different things. Ability, like, you could be the greatest player in the world, but you're boring and you don't know what's good. Who cares? You could be a complete hack, but you have some sense of what you like. You could do something. So what's more important, man, is it the ability, the sensibility? Well, since sensibility is more important, if you put that into everything you do, people feel it. You know, people feel it. Like, wow, that's something real, man. Like, you just saw something real. You just heard something real. And that's a beautiful thing to put in music. So to me, everything is rock and roll. I can't help it. I mean, really, literally, like, I'm playing stuff that is, like, straight up, like, jazz. And in my mind, I'm like, ah, yeah, like, just beating it up, because that's how I approach it. I can't help it.
Nice. Well, I really enjoyed this conversation, Jack, because I've got a whole new appreciation for your take on not just music, but it sounds like on life. Like, In one way, I feel like I understand you a little bit more, but on the other hand, like, so much less than I even did before we started talking.
Oh, that's good. And, yes. Successful.
So, anyways, I thank you so much for taking so much time.
My gosh, yes.
And thank you guys for putting your time into your show. You know, it's an important thing, and I'm glad you're giving people a voice. And, you know, for those people that are curious on the subject, it's an interesting examination for them. I really enjoyed the show with Chris, and I'll definitely be sure to check out some of the other episodes you guys have done.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
You guys have a great evening.
All right, Jack. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, guys.
You rock, right, brother.
Bye-bye.
Wow.
Dude, Jack Watterson is... That's a baller.
Oh, wow.
That's a baller.
My mind is blown, Soraya, right now.
He was serving up some straight philosophy.
Yes.
Today.
Yeah. I feel like I'm sitting in a pew, and, like, there was some preaching going on right now. Some street preaching. And not preaching, but I don't know. Man, what a guy!
Yes,
and
I will agree with you.
If you listen, if you go through and you listen to, like, all of the stuff that he's been involved with, it's insanely diverse. Like, more than,
and that's exactly what he said. You know, there's this real diverse arc in his artistic output, and, you know, his current projects are really intriguing because it mixes so many influences.
Yeah, absolutely.
Together. But, you know, I gotta say, I'm a hip-hop fan, and the fact that he's worked with people like Rakim, like early hip-hop. Rakim is one of the best MCs out there, and Ghostface Killah, and, you know, Kendrick Lamar. I mean, he was rattling those names off, and I got, you know, I was equally as impressed as, you know, the people he was mentioning, you know, in his early band days. And I like his attitude.
Me too.
I like his attitude and his approach to music and to making music. It's like, you know, you got to take risks. You got to push the envelope. You got to do more. And, you know, yeah, sometimes it'll be great. Sometimes it'll be bad, but, you know what? You know, who cares? Whatever. You just got to do it.
Yeah. And he was saying, like, towards the beginning, that he actually enjoys it when people come up to him and say that they hate him. They hate what they did.
That was the quote of the chat with him. Because when you think about it, he was right. Because when people say, oh, man, that sucks, it comes from a place of pure expression, like, and pure truth. But, you know, when people say, oh, I loved it, he goes, you know, I have no idea if they're really being genuine. But when people say, man, that sucked, it comes from a place of absolute truth. That is, You know, we waited a long time to talk to Jack.
Yes, yeah. We've been wanting to talk to him.
Did not disappoint.
No. I still got to...
Pat was right. Pat Thomas was right.
I got to tell you, though, Soraya, like, some of that stuff, I'm still... Like, even that, like, I'm having a hard time, like, grasping that, like, being okay with someone coming up to you after a show and saying, I hate what you did. And I understand the reasoning by it, but it's still something that... I'm going to have to tackle this for a couple days. Like, that doesn't come easy for me to hear or to internalize that. So I'm going to have to sit on that for a while. That's tough for me.
Oh my gosh.
But what's not tough for me was the philosophy. He mentioned Rocky Horror Picture Show a couple times. Don't dream it, be it.
Be it.
I absolutely love that. It just, get out there and do it. And I loved his philosophy to putting together music. Even this album, he said, he's not going to spend a whole lot of time, you know, like overthinking it. He's just going to do it and put it out there like a kite. Put the kite together, cut the string, and let it go. Isn't that...
And you know, towards the end, he said, I think he was talking about, like, the last album. He said, you know, I'm just going to play and, you know, I just want to get it over with, you know, like I just want it to be done. And when you think about it, anytime anyone tries to do something that maybe is out of their comfort zone, there's a lot of apprehension and anxiety. And what he's saying is you kind of got to embrace that moment and just be willing to put it out there. And I think no one can look at Jack's artistic resume and say, this guy has played it safe.
No,
he's taken chances and he's put it out there and he's willing to try new things.
Oh yeah.
And I admire that about him.
Absolutely.
And you know, what did he say? He said, you know, I'm 61 years old and, you know, I still get to play and I still get to be active with my craft and I'm appreciative of that.
Awesome.
You know, it's a great thing. And I really liked what he said about how for musicians when people still care about what they've done, he says, you know, that's really a benefit and that's really something that I'm proud of. It's something to take in, you know? I like that. Oh, that's a cool dude. Yeah. He's a baller. Yeah. I like him.
Agreed. Woo! Well,
I could have listened to him for like 3 more hours.
Yeah, and for a lot of it, we just were. Yeah, absolutely.
But Jack Watterson, great chat.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And when the Midnight Hour plays again, I am going to be there.
I think many of us need to be there. I just, you know, I want to see what he does next.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Jeff. All right. Let's end this. I mean, we got, there's nothing more to say. We got a lot of thinking to do.
Yes, indeed. He put a lot of things out there that I need to sit on for a little while.
Absolutely. Gente, agrubiar.
Groove on, Paisley people. Thank you.
Yeah.